Well, good afternoon and welcome everybody to a delayed beginning of this term's Israel Studies Seminar Series. It's an honor and delight to present to you our speaker today, Dr. Muriel Ram, a political and cultural geographer, currently a postdoctoral researcher at SOAS. Muriel's main research interest lies in exploring how matter matters in unstable environments. Among other issues, he has written on the militarization of natural resources in contested territories in the Middle East and the Mediterranean, the infrastructure of faith and religion in Israel's contested urban environments, the interaction between human lives and medical equipment in the development of clinical aid to African states, and the representation of dead matter in popular culture through the figure of the zombie. And the title of his talk today is A Tale of Sand and Snow, the Barlev Line, and the Hermon Ski Site as Material Fantasies. Maria, thank you for coming.
Thank you. So I'm happy to talk about zombies, but it will have to wait to the end of this lecture. Thank you so much, Yaakov, for this opportunity. I'm really excited to be here. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah.
So I'm apologizing to the microphone that I need to stand up, because usually it helps me during the presentation.
It's perfect.
And basically, I will try to talk loud, but I only want I look at this seminar as an opportunity to think out loud, in a way, to present you a project I've been working on for the last year, which is kind of like a convergence point between what I've been working before, during my PhD, in a sense, and what I'm trying to do now. So my talk basically looks at, discusses what I call the fragile nature of geopolitical fantasies. I want to talk about it through the relation between space taking and place making. And the spaces being taken and the places being made are these two places, which I'm sure you heard about, the Sinai Peninsula and the Golan Heights. I'll just briefly refresh your memory about those two spaces. Both of them were occupied by Israel in the 1967 war. The Golan Heights is an elevated plateau located between Israel, Syria, and Jordan, approximately 1,500 square kilometers of territory, 400 meters above sea level. And the Sinai Peninsula, which is three times larger than Israel, was under Egyptian territorial sovereignty, and Israel occupied it in 1967, in June 1967, and relinquished it eventually in 1982, I think, was the last Israeli soldier, civilian, who was there with the dismantlement of the Yamit settlement. So what was interesting to me about these two territories was, first of all, their relation to two main bodies of knowledge relating to Israel-Palestine, the literature about the conflict. The first body of knowledge, I like to call it occupation studies. So usually, when I talk about this body of knowledge, I use this, the Israeli landed at Heathrow Airport, the control, the officer asked occupation, and the Israeli answers, no, just for visit. And I always, when we moved into London and we started to get letters, and they always started with dear occupiers. And I told my wife, they may be critical, but they are polite. And how do they know that Israelis are living here? Because kind of like occupation, conceptually speaking, is a moment both of interruption, but a moment of interpretation, or different meaning of how to understand space, how to understand politics of controlling space. In this case, not just only as a vocation in space, but a control of space. And within the bodies of knowledge dealing with occupation in the context of Israel or Israel-Palestine, it is either from the perception of the biopolitical perspective, if you look at the work of Niv Gordon or the work of Yael Barda, or from the perspective of theological tendencies toward this territory, if you look at the work of Michael Feige and Gideon Alan, or from the kind of like what I call a West Bank centric, in the sense that it mainly deals with Israel settlements in the West Bank. If you look kind of like the very important work being written by people like Gershom Gorenberg, Kiva Eldar and Zartal, or Avi Raz, who is from here actually. So most of the work of the occupation studies dealing either with these three layers, three branches, biopolitics in the sense of governance of lives, mostly of the Palestinians in the West Bank, the theological discussion about the return, the promised land, the biblical scripture, the tension between Israel's secular identity to its religious one, and so forth. I know I'm being simplistic here, but kind of like if I try to draw a big picture. And most of them deal with the West Bank, with some of the work kind of like looking at the Gaza Strip, but not too much. Usually it is lumped together, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. But less work is made in regard to the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula. Now let's leave the Sinai Peninsula for a moment on the side. We'll return to there. But in relation to the Golan Heights, it's quite an interesting place in a sense. It has quite literally a paradoxical nature. Kind of like this, one of the central areas of a conflict in the Middle East, which is constantly being imagined or offered or envisioned as kind of like a Europe, in a sense. As you see this this invitation mostly to Israelis to come to experience, this is the transition, the Golan, the most Europe as it ever gets. This winter you are going for a European holiday. Leave the passport at home. The Golan is filled with water, flower, and silence. It's Israeli silence without any disturbances. And it is kind of like a bucolic landscape in a sense, which relates to the way in which the territory was occupied and the nature of the landscape, in which you have the Hermon Mountain, which I'm gonna talk about a bit, and the whole landscape, which is crisscrossed by anti-tank trenches and bunkers. Some of them are used as coffee places and minefields and so on and so on. And what is interesting in this paradoxical nature is the very materiality which enables this process or this act of imagination. In this case, the materiality of snow, which imagines to re-envision, rediscuss the Golan as the most Europe as a place in Israel can get. Moving on to the Sinai, is what is interesting about the Sinai, this is the silence, the literature, the silence in the literature about the period in which Israel controlled the Sinai Peninsula. Granted, it was indeed a short time. Nevertheless, Israel controlled a territory three times its size, a place in which two of the most devastating conflicts in Israeli historiography took place. The War of Attrition, which is usually not really brought up in the public discourse, and the October War, which started in the Sinai, and usually is discussed as a watershed moment in Israeli historiography. Nevertheless, when you are talking about the literature dealing with what I call occupation studies, there's not much about this process, this period, even though I think we can think beyond the Sinai to see how the process of control, of thinking about the space there, of the occupation of the Sinai, can tell us some things about, as I said, space taking and placemaking in a sense. And I just brought up this movie, this great movie, Avanti Popolo from 1984, which was actually made inside Israel. This is in the sands of Rishon LeZion. But in a sense, was one of the few movies or texts, in a sense, literary academic texts that dealt with the Sinai as a space and Israel's presence there. And this leads me, in a way, to the second body of knowledge. If the first was occupation studies, as I said, the second body of knowledge I'm interested in is the material, what is usually discuss in relation to what is called the social sciences, the material term. So what is the material term? Academics like to talk in turn. Every now and then there's kind of like a paradigmatic shift in the way in which we understand and talk about social science. So we had the discursive turn, in a sense, when people started to look more carefully at text and deconstruct them, following Derrida and Foucault. And we had the spatial turn, following Lefebvre and Desarteaux and David Harvey, which we start to think more seriously about how space is not a given, but a construct, something which is being constantly made through political relations, through cultural narratives. And the material turn kind of like dovetails it in the way in which it urges us to think about the very object and items and the things that we use, and the way in which they themselves emanate all kind of power fields. They are not only silent objects, but have political agency of themselves. So you find a lot of you find a lot of material dealing with things like barbed wire, tear gas, aluminium, concrete, dirt, rubble, waste, and more. All of these topics were dealt by different kind of academics trying to see, to understand how these objects have a narrative of their own, have a presence of their own, have an agency of their own, and not necessarily simply elements that reflect human action, but elements that shape it in a way. So, what I'm interested here is to think about how elements, in this case, elements of the environment, also operate as agents of power, also change political relations, also impact the way in which we understand politics. And I want to do it through thinking about two such elements, the snow in the case of the Golan Heights and the sand in the case of the Sinai. So if you want to think about sand, which of course has much more conspicuous presence in Israel, then we can look at, for example, dune fixation schemes, which started from the moment, actually from when Britain started to enter Israel, to enter Palestine in a sense. And the dune fixation scheme was a way not only to think about the role of the environment and the politics of an environment, but also the elements of the environment which either enables or hinders the possibility of transformation, of political transformation of the territorial unit known as Mandatory Palestine. So this is part of the dune fixation scheme, which was developed and was conceived by British colonial officers. And there's this kind of like reflection about the urgency of dealing with sand, which might serve as a possible hindrance to the development of the country. So this is kind of like a reflection of one of the officers at the end of the recommendation whether or not to develop the scheme basically dealing with controlling sand. I would end as I began by saying that I think it in the highest degree important that a scheme broadly on these lines should be instituted without delay. The Arab population of Palestine is increasing immensely fast, and we are constantly urged to cram more and more Jews into the country. So I apologize for the officer for his very crude language, but in a sense we can understand how sand is also a factor being considered into this calculation of the emerging conflict or the very life conflict between Jews and Arabs, between the Zionist movement and the Palestinian localities. And not only from the perspective of kind of like political geography, but also cultural geography, to think about sand in the way in which it kind of like imbricated itself into the national narrative of the Zionist movement. Look at these two songs, for example, by Nathan Alterman, both of them from the same year, from 1934. Wake up, sand, because cement is upon you. This is a song dedicated to the construction of Tel Aviv, which in kind of like the classical Israeli narrative was built, emerged out of the sand. If you look at the work of Mike Levine, for example, about the history of Tel Aviv. And another song, the road song, as we stretch roads of concrete in the sand. So sand was imagined as an adversary, as a project to deal with, in a sense. And we can see here both how sand becomes a political element, we can see how it stretches into the construction of a myth or rejuvenation, but it also has a fantastical aspect to it, in a sense. And this brings us to the issue of how to think on the relation between material elements and fantasies, which is kind of like the main thing I want to think about in this conversation in relation to the role of materiality such as sand and snow in the context of the Golan Heights and the Sinai. So, for example, when you're thinking about spaces of fantasies, a fantasy is a word that's been thrown around a lot in relation to the ideological narratives of national identities, not only in Israel, but since we are talking about Israel, I brought this passage from Yazor Bavel's book, A Desert in the Promised Land, in which the focus of the book itself is on the desert. But we can see, of course, sand plays a crucial role there. But for Zerubbabel, she speaks about how the desert itself appeared in the Zionist narrative as a metaphoric bubble, a mythical space or fantasy that conveys no goal or purpose. Now, I think it's important to think about fantasies from kind of like a conceptual vantage point. To think about how should we understand fantasies in a sense, not just kind of like gloss it over as another form of myth. But fantasies have a role somewhat different than myths in a sense. So there are different ways to conceptualize fantasies. If we look kind of like on the Marxist tradition that looks at ideology as a form of fantasy, as a way in which kind of like we mask social relations, okay, the false conscious argument, okay? Then we see the progress of this discussion in kind of like post-Marxist thought, especially with Zizek, his post-Lacanian thought, which looks at fantasies not as a way to move away from social reality, but a way to construct social reality, to construct a notion of reality that kind of like enables to move away from different things we want to engage with. So in a sense, fantasies are defense mechanism. This is kind of like the literature of psychoanalysis and Lacanian literature deals a lot with fantasies as a form of individual defense mechanism. But what kind of like perhaps differs fantasies from ideologies is the notion of acknowledgement, that it is kind of like an imaginative step, a way to articulate desire, not necessarily a way to set up a plan, which kind of like when we relate to ideology is a way to think about how to create a reality, but fantasy is a way to move away from reality, to acknowledge the fact that we are setting a border between reality and fiction. The second thing is that fantasies sometimes emerge when ideologies run out of steam. When you think about making a country great again or taking back control, when ideologies are starting to get to run thin, fantasies emerge. And the third thing is that fantasies usually look for a place to articulate themselves. When we are thinking about fantasies usually, and this is kind of like maybe returning to the spatial term, we need to think about places from which fantasies can take shape. So when we think about this, for example, this is from 1950. Dan Ben-Amos looks, 1959, sorry, a snowstorm, a rare occurrence in Israel, takes place. And Dan Ben-Amos writes about how the snow began on Tuesday and transformed the Jerusalem landscape outside our window into a real winter from our childhood books, poems, and drawing. All the colors that we associate with the word home suddenly vanished as snowflakes covered the red roofs, blue skies, black earth, and green grass with a blinding whiteness. We gaze at images of a land abroad of which we never encountered. Note that Dan Ben-Amos didn't encounter it because he came from Eastern Europe. The chief one, but of course in Eastern Europe, he wasn't Dan Ben-Amos, he was at, what was his name? Exactly. The cheerful ringing of bells, an East European aristocrat covered in fur traveling in a sled, a blizzard on the King's Road to Bobrovsk, wolves are howling in the forest calling to white fan, Jensen's scientific expedition slowly moves forward towards the Arctic, Eskimo drinking whale lard inside rounded ice cabins. Wherever you look, just snow, snow, snow. Now this is Jerusalem, right? This is kind of like the snow, right? You want to tell him, take it down a notch. But exactly see how the elements of the environment participate in this moment of fantastic imagination, which is acknowledged by the author. It is acknowledged in this construction of kind of like a place elsewhere, outside. In a sense, literally, when we think about how Israelis speak about abroad, in Hebrew it's chutz la'aretz, being outside of the country, through thought and through the materiality of snow, which have a very, like sand, have a very fluid materiality, constantly rematerialize and dematerialize it, in a sense. So, moving to 1967, what happens in 1967 in relation to the production of this fantastic spaces? And in this case, we can look at the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula as two wonderlands, in a sense, when we think about their relation to the West Bank, to the discussion about the theological return. In relation to this narrative of return, the arrival into the Sinai and the Golan was always conceptualized as a secular opportunity of expansion, rather than going back to the place of our fathers, in a sense. So we found kind of like this perspective from a children's book called Azit, which was later turned into a very popular movie in Israel. This is from 1969. Israel is poor in tall highlands. The Hermon is covered in snow for months, years even. The Hermon is the tallest mountain in the Golan Heights, located at the northern tip of the Golan. For many years, Israeli gazed upon the Hermon. Only the most daring of the youth ventured out in the dark of night beyond enemy lines and ascended it, to hike its paths and discover its wonders. Until now, an enemy stood between us and the Hermon, who not only prevented us from enjoying the mountain, but also repeatedly bombed and shelled us. So first, he prevented us from enjoying the mountain. How dare he prevented us from enjoying the sun. And by the way, also bombed and shelled us. One day, this enemy declared war, and its forces descended upon us. When you look at the historiography of the war, if you read the works of, the one that was the ambassador, Michael Oren, kind of like the definitive piece of the Six-Day War, the place, the role that Syria played in the war, it was there, but it was relatively minor until the very end of the war in relation to what happened in the Egyptian front and the Jordanian front. One day the enemy declared war and its forces descended upon us. One tank, actually, in the war tried to enter Israel, attacking our settlements with tanks and cannon. This is how the war broke out. This is how we returned to the Hermon speak. So first of all, we see here the constant conjoinment of ideology and myth, ideology and fantasy, because you have to have a narrative of return, right? It's kind of like central, even though the Zionist movement never articulated its connection to the Golan Heights within the language of returning to some place. It was always articulated in the sense of we need to control this area for strategic purposes and for the fact that it controls most of the water in the territory, or maybe environmental reasons. But in the literary sense, it's always in a narrative of return. But then we see how the fantasy takes over. The gaze to the mountain, and not just to the mountain, but to the snow on the mountain, in a sense. And mind you, this book was not written by an author, but by a general. This is a book written by Mordechai Gur, which later became at the time of the book was published, he was the commander of the Northern Command of Israel. Later on, also became General Chief of Staff. So there's a politics here to the construction of the fantasy. And the construction of the fantasy, which is acknowledged as a sort of imagination, as a sort of a non-place, also entails a degree of violence. For example, in the case of the Sinai Peninsula, people like Eliezer Bruscus, which was a central figure in the planning, in the spatial construction of Israel, playing a figure role in the 50s and the 60s, in the way in which Israel was conceived as a space, the production of development towns and the large plans of Israel. If you know the Sharon plan, for example, and others, Eliezer Bruscus takes part in thinking about what to do with the Sinai. And he says that the greatest advantage of the area, this is from the archives, of the area, is in the qualities that from a first glance may seem as disadvantage. And that is the region's wild character. Europe has no desert, and the colorful pictures of the Bay Area with its adjacent area of the Sinai Mountains has a priori power of attraction as an exotic landscape to the European tourist. Now, he's mainly talking about the Sinai, but when the conversation started to converge toward the area where a possible Israeli Riviera can be established in order to attract tourists, this was the location, a place very close to what is Rafah today at the edge of the Gaza Strip. And the plans also, by the way, included the construction of a nuclear reactor. This is from the planning map. And the idea was to create there an Israeli Riviera, but the Sam Brooks also says that in order to construct this fantasy, that we learn from experience in Israel and abroad that the image is the first condition for a city's success. He's talking here in relation to the establishment of Yamit in the Sinai Peninsula as a place out of sand, utilizing sand as a source of attraction. That the image in the first is the first condition for a city's success, and especially for a city of this kind. Image also determines the ability to attract outside funding, and this image will no doubt be damaged by a direct neighborhood link to Rafah and its refugee camps, both from the social psychological aspects and from an environmental visual one. So the fantasy has to be clean. There should be clear borders to that fantasy, and we know from the work of Gorenberg and David Kretschmer that in fact Israel evacuated or displaced about 5,000 to 20,000 Bedouins living in the area of Yamit before it established this imagined Riviera in a place located far away from Gaza. So there's a certain element of violence to the production of fantastic space, more so in the Hermon. So the amazement of the snow was not only limited to the Israeli view, but also from people eager to take part in the reshaping of the Golan Heights. For example, this from a potential donor from America that is talking with the Israeli authorities about the possibility of developing the Golan Heights in relation to the snow. As to why I'm so eager to assist your efforts, this is a subject that could fill many volumes. As recently as last May, I gazed upon the slopes of Mount Hermon, both from the Syrian and Lebanese side of the border, as well as from the Israeli side. Little did I think that Israelis would soon be skiing on those slopes, which then looked almost as distant as the moon, and considerably more hostile. Now, snow itself became, within the correspondence of the Israeli authorities, the civilian and the military one, became one of the main elements that justified the development of the Golan Heights. A whole authority called Hermon Authority, the authority of the mountains, was established in order to develop the northern part of the Golan Heights. And because of the snow was deemed such as an important resource, it also justified the destruction and erasure of the Syrian village, which was located where later on an Israeli settlement, Neve Ativ, would be established. So there's the Syrian village was called Jubata Azit, and this is from the correspondence about Jubata, is there's no way to clear up Jubata in time. So in a sense, this was part of a larger erasure movement within the Golan Heights, where about 270 Syrian settlements and a population of between 90,000 to 130,000 civilians fled and were never allowed to return, basically were displaced. So the production of fantasy, either in the case of the Sinai or in the case of the Hermon, also entails an act of violence to create this image, this pristine image of materiality, of elementality in a sense, of the snow. And the importance of the snow, the importance of creating the fantasy also justifies the usage of violence by the state in a sense. But and it also, the very materiality of the snow also creates all different kind of interesting slippages, in a sense. Because the snow itself never behaved like the developers wanted it to. It constantly melted, basically, because it's not Switzerland. And the Israeli flocked to the Hermon in order to participate in this environmental fantasy. So we see all kind of correspondence with ski instructors complaining about how Israelis behave, even though they have been shown kind of like movies from European ski clubs, what is the right way to act. They still push, they still don't know how to stand in line, and the snow itself constantly disappears, in a sense. And so we see how this is kind of like from one of the newspapers. The mountain has whitened from shame. Bodies are sanding together, creating a chaos that renders the Hermon a resemblance of a Tel Aviv seashore. But in a sense, in this kind of like large socializing project of behaving properly in the snow, the snow itself didn't behave properly because it constantly melted, in a sense. But what is interesting, for example, this is a passage from an author and a journalist called Yeshayahu Avrech from 1973, when he talks about skiing on the Hermon. So we are told it's part of the acting out of our national presence in the Golan Heights. But it is not by rejoicing in snow that a mountain is redeemed. it's not with skis that, sorry for the typos there, that ownership is purchased, and not by skiing that the land is conquered. So this is an interesting kind of like reflection in a way in which fantasies and ideologies also can move apart, move away. And the fact is that you can either have the myth of return, of redeeming the land, or the normality of skiing. You can't have both. You can't articulate a desire for normality and a justification to control. This is a moment in which fantasies not only emerge outside of the ideological fervor, of the feeling ideological imperative to control the territory, not only emerge from it, but also clash with it. But this was in, this text is from February 73, the height of the ski season. Of course, in October 73, after the October War, the narrative about the mountain significantly changed. And this brings us to the second construct and returns us to the Sinai to think about the ultimate, in a sense, military fantasy constructed on the tip of the Sinai, on the Suez Canal, which is the Barlev line, in a sense. So, immediately following the war, immediately following the 67 war, the fighting itself never subsided, in a sense. I mean, it subsided, but it continued to take place. And Israel decided to control the line over the Suez Canal. And slowly there emerged a debate whether or not to remain over the Suez Canal itself, or to withdraw a little bit and send mobile forces in order to patrol there, or to show a presence. And the decision was made by Barlev, the head chief of staff, and Dayan in the end, the security minister, that there should be a constant Israeli presence on the bank of the Suez Canal as a show of force. Now, what is interesting, first of all, is to think about the imperial layers that relates to this decision of having a presence on the Suez Canal, because the Suez Canal itself is a imperial project, in a sense. Imperial idea that to create a human construct in order to enable movement. And the fortification line, which slowly started to emerge at the banks of the canal, was using, actually, building as another layer on the imperial layer, which started with the dredging of the canal itself. Now, usually in the discussion over the creation of the fortification line, which eventually became the Barlev line, it is usually discussed in relation to the, as I mentioned, the war of attrition, which started around March 1969, and the October War of 73. However, what is important to understand here, it's not that the fortification line began because, it's not that the fortification project began because of the war of attrition. It was the war of attrition which was a response to the fortification itself. The response of the Egyptian forces seeing the Israelis fortifying themselves on the banks of the Sinai, of the Suez Canal. What's important here is that sand became embroiled within this fortification project. First of all, it enabled it in the sense that the dredging of the Suez Canal created the elemental features enabling the construction of a fortification over on the west bank of the canal. And then it was contracted in order to fortify it, and also private contractors were hired in order to construct it, eventually leading to a construction of a huge and a massive project, which cost the state about $200 million, a line stretching over 160 kilometers, 30 outposts, well fortified, and layers, not only of materials, but of different historical periods. So we had sand from the dredging of the Suez. We had railway tracks being placed on the outpost, being taken apart from the mandatory railway tracks from El Arish to Kantara. We had blocks being moved from quarries in the Sinai, but also some from the West Bank. We had private contractors being very economical with the way in which they were actually hired to do the job. They used sand, basically, in order to be very free in the depiction of how much work they really invested, because the fact that they were asked to create, to use this amount of stones, so in order to cut some costs, simply filled it up with sand, the gabions, this project, this big fortification nets that in which stones and sand was poured into. And we see in the archives and in the reports following the fortification how much frustrated the military was with the way in which these private contractors used this national project in order to enrich themselves. The joke, by the way, after the 1973 war, was that the only thing remaining from the Barlev line was the villas in Herzliya of the contractors. And we will talk a little bit at the end what was really left from the Barlev line. But the Barlev line itself, look at this depiction from a visit of a French reporter somewhere in 69. Mostofa, he's visiting an outpost, okay? He's going into an outpost. Most sofas of the outpost are centered in an Ali Baba cave inside one of the dunes supported by metal beams. Inside this subterranean hall, there are many treasures, a film screen, pearl-coated canteen, and the bottles of scotch and Perrier that are hanging from the ceiling. So it was indeed not just it was more of a political project than a military one, in a sense. What is important here is that the Israeli commanders, whether it was Barlev, the head chief of staff, Sharon, which later became the commander of the southern front, which actually hated the Barlev line and tried basically to dilute it and destroy it in a sense, and other commanders were aware to the fact that the line was all basically an artifact of show and tell. It was basically there to show presence and to tell an alert about potential encroachment of Egyptian forces. It was never meant to stop an invasion. Even the name itself, Barlev line, a reference to the Maginot line because it worked so well for the French. In a sense, it was a self-acknowledging, the generals themselves acknowledged that this is not a final line of defense. But it also created, so this self-acknowledgement of an illusion, in a way, of this construction of a defense mechanism is what created this notion of fantasy. And the atmosphere itself, a surreal atmosphere, especially by the soldiers in the line, was a sense of fantasy. If you look at the how Moshe Shamir, which is a known Israeli author, visiting the line, again, like Avrech, a few months before the war. On the road north, a sandstorm came on top of us, a ring one. First, it looks like a happy dance of a million tiny demons playing on dunes, sliding down on the slopes. Then it slowly picked up the pace. In one threatening moment, we were overwhelmed under the forces of nature. A giant wall, yellow, reddish, turning on us as the horror of Judgment Day. We crossed it, whiplash blind, until we punched through and beyond there, a beacon of salvation, a green sign of the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, that had one of those weird names from a distant fantasy. It was a self-acknowledging fantasy in a way, a creation of a political line that kind of like relates to this idea of the barrier to the East, the famous what Herzl in his writing wrote about. To Europe will be a wall against Asia, this notion of the wall, of construction of a wall. Of course, Herzl would have lived today, would say, we will be a wall against Asia and we will make Asia pay for it. But he was writing in the 19th century. And both the Barlev line and the Hermon, the outpost on the Hermon, in a sense, which was constructed on top of the ski site, were both artifacts, in a sense, of show and tell, of projecting a mind, not just reporting. They also had political and security roles, but also had a cultural role of constructing this fantasy of impregnability, in a sense. And again, like the case of the snow, which constantly slipped and creates slippages in the idea of securing the fantasy of a ski site, sand itself also was kind of like a matter with its own political impetus. Eventually, when the invasion started in 1973, it was the fact that the whole fortification line, which was built on sand, enabled these Egyptian engineers to erode the sand by using water pumps from the canal, in a sense. That was what enabled the actual invasion and the breach of the wall, in a sense. And following the war, basically immediately after the war, Israel never returned to the Bar-Lev line. The Suez Canal remained in Egyptian hands, and slowly but surely Israel vacated the Sinai piece by piece until 1982. In 1976, when reporters reported about the outpost, one of the outposts of the Bar-Lev line, actually during the October War, all of the outposts of the line, over the line, were taken by the Egyptian forces in 2 days, except one, the Budapest outpost, the famous outpost that was right on top, at the top of the northern part point of the line. So the Budapest outpost has been disbanded, the rock layers transferred, underground bunkers disbanded, and all is left is a pile of sand. And in a sense, it is quite amazing, the story of the Bar-Lev line, not just its construction, not just the way in which it was envisioned at the time as this impregnable line that cannot be breached, even though the generals and the political high echelon acknowledged that the fact it could be breached. By the way in which it vanished, in a sense, disappeared completely from the discussion, from the public conversation, in a sense, following the October War. And actually, the only museums commemorating the line are Egyptian museums over in the Sinai Peninsula, celebrating what in the Egyptian public memory is regarded as a victory, the ability to cross over. But in the Israeli public discussion, the Bar-Lev line itself almost completely, maybe not disappeared, but kind of like diminished in its presence. However, fantasies tend to move on. And we see how, for example, the same rationality leading to the construction of the Bar-Lev line moved on to the construction of the security barrier in southern Lebanon, in a sense, with the same very much discourse of creating a distant line of fortifications that will serve as the ultimate defense. And when this line crumbled, in a sense, it moved on to the separation barrier in the West Bank. And currently we see the same kind of like discourse and narrative in relation to Iron Dome. And the technology keeps getting better. Actually, the war of attrition in itself, one of the truism in Israeli public discourse is that the war of attrition, in which the Bar-Lev line was the main star in a sense, that the war of attrition evaporated from the Israel's public memory. It might be so, but from the perspective of military muscle memory, in a sense, it remained very present, because this is the war that enabled the notion of we can have a static warfare, in which we create a line of defense that constantly can be eroded and maintained in the price of kind of like human life. We can have new technology of static warfare, in a sense. This is the war of attrition, which we see for the first time Israel activating drones, in a sense. And this is the war, in a sense, that creates this notion of the fortification. And in thinking about this fortification as a form of fantasy, might enable us to understand how these ideas move around and are also based, structured, and fractured, in a sense, on the very elemental materialities which sustain them. So I will end up here. Thank you very much.